Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. I'm Anand Jagatia. Back in 2008, researchers from Google announced that they could predict outbreaks of the flu by monitoring people's Google search behaviour.
What's the best remedy for a sore throat?
Antibiotics for a cold.
See my doctor.
What are symptoms of flu?
Influenza is a serious disease. Worldwide, the WHO estimates that there are 3 to 5 million severe cases every year and up to 500,000 deaths. With millions of people submitting Google searches every day, this approach to monitoring flu in the US was a really smart idea. By picking up on increases in flu-related searches, the algorithm claimed to be able to predict flu outbreaks 2 weeks earlier than data from the US authorities, the Center for Disease Control, or the CDC. But here's the thing, it didn't actually work. For all the hype, in the end, Google Flu Trends failed pretty badly. It consistently and systematically overestimated the number of flu cases by as much as 50%. So what went wrong?
We have to be very careful because, for instance, when we look at the aggregated searches on web platforms, on search engines, we need really to understand, are the people searching for the flu because somebody's sick in the family, or they are searching because there is a surge of interest in the media, or there is a flu and they are talking about, you know, avian flu somewhere else?
This is Alessandro Vespignani from Northeastern University in the US.
And then there are also other issues. For instance, web searching algorithms are changing, and so they are often a black box. For instance, they can suggest search keywords when you are typing or doing other things that alter or biases those searches. And so, you know, in a sense, we need to be aware of those biases. We need to be aware of the biases introduced by media interest, many, many, many things.
Alessandro is a professor in computer science, physics, and health sciences. He co-wrote a paper in 2014 trying to get to the bottom of what went wrong with Google Flu Trends. The paper talks about how simply having lots of data isn't a substitute for proper analysis of that data. For example, Google Flu Trends was vulnerable to search terms that had nothing to do with flu, but just happened to be correlated to the flu season in winter, like searches for high school basketball, simply because the basketball season overlaps with the flu season. The workaround was simply to throw out peculiar search terms like this on an ad hoc basis. But this meant that Google Flu Trends totally failed to predict the H1N1 flu pandemic in 2009, which happened outside the normal flu season. In short, the authors say that Google Flu Trends was part flu detector and part winter detector.
That means that we need to understand better what are the social mechanisms behind the use of social media so that we can better rely on the signal when we analyze diseases. And some of those problems affected Google Flu Trend in their analysis of the flu season. That doesn't mean that Google Flu Trend is not a very good idea. Actually, it really has broken ground in the area, introducing the use of social media. But obviously, there is still much more work that we have to do.
Google Flu Trends was shut down in 2015, but it certainly highlighted the potential of exploiting this wealth of untapped data for disease monitoring. Scientists call this digital epidemiology, and today it's progressed far beyond just web platform searches. Researchers are tracking outbreaks using data from Wikipedia searches, dinner cancellations on apps like OpenTable, and, in particular, Twitter. For one thing, Twitter is a completely open forum. Anyone can access and analyse tweets as they're posted, whereas, as Alessandro says, platforms like Google are more of a black box. But there are other benefits too.
Twitter is very immediate, so you can look at Twitter messages in real time. Then you can do natural language processing more easily because it's a 140-character long message. And so, you know, this is people declaring about their fever status, their cough, the fact that they are feeling miserable and things like that.
Twitter might act as a better proxy for people's actual experiences compared to Google searches, because that's kind of what Twitter is for. It's a microblogging platform.
Typically with Twitter, people are telling you what's happening to them. Yet on the other hand, somebody on Google might look up flu because they're worried about getting it. So therefore, it tends to be a bit more of an accurate signal of what is really happening. And that's why I think there's a lot of interest in using it.
This is Professor Guy Poppy, Chief Scientific Advisor to the Food Standards Agency in the UK. Over the past few years, the FSA has been working on a tool that uses data from Twitter, not to track the flu, but to predict outbreaks of norovirus.
I'm sure many of your listeners may have had the unfortunate experience of having norovirus. It actually costs the UK economy about £100 million a year, and it's not very pleasant. It tends to come on very rapidly and involves projectile vomiting and often diarrhoea too. And a certain amount of it is caused by food, but one of the real problems is once one individual gets it, it's spread rapidly amongst lots of other individuals. One of the ways you can get it from food is by eating food like berries or other products, seafood and that, which you may not prepare properly and therefore be exposed to the virus. I live in Southampton, and the cruise ships there often suffer, in which if a few people get it, the whole cruise ship can be a problem. And that's why we've been interested in trying to identify very early that norovirus is in the population, so that there are things we can do to stop it spreading.
Personally, I've never found the idea of going on a cruise appealing, and that story only serves to confirm my suspicions. The FSA's approach has been to track the use of certain hashtags on Twitter in the UK to warn them of potential outbreaks of norovirus.
We worked in a very, what we'd call an interdisciplinary team. So we worked with people who were social scientists, people who are experts on how people behave, and mathematicians. And the idea was that we would identify what are the typical words that somebody puts onto Twitter with a hashtag when they have become ill through eating some food. And then we can use the latest techniques in monitoring a Twitter feed. And then you can see that they're being used more frequently. So there's a movement away from a low level to a higher level. And when that has happened for 2 or 3 weeks consecutively, you can then begin to say, hang on, I think there's a signal here, let's look closely. And if that signal then is being associated with people picking this up in the health service, we can then say we have got a positive outbreak here, it is growing. And therefore, there are things that we can put out in messaging to people about hygiene and not going out if you've got this illness and not mixing with people, which can then stop the outbreak getting more extreme and spreading.
Now, there are obvious difficulties with monitoring information of this kind. Let's have a look at what kind of things people are tweeting about right now. So if we search for the hashtags ill and sick, we've got somebody called Amber saying, she hasn't felt this sick in a long time. Hashtag ill, hashtag sick. Trust me to get ill 2 weeks before I go on holiday. Hashtag ill, hashtag sick, hashtag quick recovery. Get well soon. When all you want is food, but you are too ill to life. Perhaps that's supposed to say live. Okay, so these people all seem pretty ill. But let's change it up. When I stay at Jesse's house with his 3 male roommates, I expected dirty, but not this bad. Hashtag vomit. Fair enough. Cereal flavoured lip balm, so disgusting, who would want that? Hashtag yuck, hashtag puke, hashtag vomit. So some of these tweets are from sick people, but the point is that not everyone using the obvious hashtags will actually be throwing up themselves, let alone infected with norovirus. But the team at the FSA has managed to get around this, partially by working out what it is that makes certain tweets irrelevant. Here's Dr. Sian Thomas, Head of Information Management at the FSA.
So pregnancy is one of the examples. Anything that's got an indication of pregnancy is automatically removed from the data set, because obviously morning sickness is going to include words like vomit and sick and all of those words, but it is going to be more likely to be morning sickness than it is to be caused by norovirus. So we take that out. Anything with any alcohol mention, so if it's about drinking, if it's about alcohol, if it's about hangover, if it's any of those things, and that gets particularly tricky just before Christmas, We also found some really random other things, like a pop group who split up at one of the times when we were doing a study, and people were saying sick a lot in the context of the names of the boys in the pop group. So we removed their names, automatically got taken out. So it's a living algorithm. It isn't something that is a kind of one-off thing.
So I did a little experiment, not very scientific, admittedly, where I searched for different hashtags like puke and vomit. But that's obviously just too simplistic. You need to take the context of the tweet into account.
That's exactly right. So it is about not just using the most obvious word, but also using the other words that may be associated with them that would indicate it isn't about norovirus.
Sian told me that she has a list of some of the phrases which help the algorithm to throw out irrelevant tweets. And I said we'd be happy for her to read them out.
No, you really wouldn't, believe me. Some of them are really disgusting.
If you send them to me instead, would you mind if I read them out?
Yeah, you can. You're very welcome to read them out.
I have to admit, actually, that some of these terms are perhaps a bit too rich for this podcast. But some of my cleaner favourites are smashed, leathered, whitey, and having it large, which is a phrase I certainly haven't heard in some time. So far, though, it seems like this approach has actually worked pretty well for norovirus, and the tool has shown very promising results.
We can see the outbreak happening about 2 weeks before it's totally confirmed in hospital records. And that 2 weeks, as you can imagine, is quite critical because you can get the interventions happening early enough to have a big impact. Things like schools and hospitals and GP surgeries are places where sick people are often in contact with many other people. So what we are working with is with NHS Choices to help them get messages to GP surgeries and schools that norovirus is in increase, the outbreaks at the start of the outbreak, and ramp up that messaging so that people behave in a certain way to stop the outbreak getting greater and stronger. So it's one of these things, you can't stop the illness from actually starting, but you can stop it becoming a much bigger issue.
Norovirus isn't called the winter vomiting bug for nothing. Cases do increase sharply in the winter, so right now the tool isn't switched on, but it will be again this autumn. The next stage is to see whether the interventions that are put in place on the back of the tool are effective at reducing the spread of norovirus, which the team is looking into now. So all of this begs the question, couldn't we just use the same algorithm for flu? Well, probably not, because in a way, norovirus is kind of the perfect infection to study and track using Twitter.
It works for norovirus because the symptoms are really specific, I think. That's what we've asked ONS, the Office for National Statistics, to look at for us, why this seems to continue to work. But when you're sick, it's a physical thing. You can't mistake it, and it is quite specific to norovirus. So norovirus causes most of the vomiting and the person-to-person transmitted vomiting illness in the UK. And we've got good evidence from other sources that that is the case. The symptoms associated with flu are more disparate. So you might have a headache, a high temperature, you might have a whole load of other symptoms that could be caused by flu, but could equally be caused by a whole load of other illnesses. So I think we might just be lucky that the symptoms we're looking for are really easy to define because they are so physical. But it also is something that's nice to study because it doesn't kill lots of people. So our interventions are quite basic. And it is really, really horrible if you've had it or know somebody who's had it. Norovirus is grim, but most people get better straight away.
You are listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. Compared to norovirus, then, flu is an entirely different beast. It does kill people, its symptoms are much more varied, and they overlap a lot with other diseases. So are there any ways that social media can help us to track its spread? Well, Alessandro Vespignani, who we heard from earlier, has been pretty busy on that front. Earlier this year, he led a team that developed a model for the CDC's Predicting the Flu Season challenge.
Our model works, first of all, recreating a synthetic world in the computer. So we really map 6.5 billion individuals in the world. We localize geographically through high-quality population maps coming from different sources. We integrate the entire airline aviation association system, mobility data, commuting data, all that create a synthetic world in the computer.
Wow.
Yeah, that's you know, this can be done nowadays.
That is insane.
Yeah, it's a lot of data that you have to ingest, but these are data that we are collecting routinely in many, many different experiments around the world. The resolution of population maps goes down to the level of 1 by 1 kilometer. So these are maps that use satellite images, light emission from satellites. They are cured by the National Space Agencies in the US. So, you know, there are really a lot of data that you can use. Well, on top of this world, you can, if you know the transmission mechanism of the disease, you can in principle simulate in the computer the progression and spreading of the disease. And if you want an analogy, this is very similar to what you do when you do weather forecast and you have the hurricane somewhere, you have equation that will describe the path of the hurricane because of all the weather data that you have, all the equation that describe the law of movement of gases and water, etc., etc. So the same is for epidemiology. You have all those movement of people. We transmit the disease during our daily contacts, and you can describe that through equations that project the disease.
The problem is that no matter how good your equations are at modelling the disease, if you don't know what the starting conditions are right now, you'll never be able to accurately predict the future. And that's where Twitter comes in.
You can use data like from Twitter and produce a kind of initial condition for where the disease is. You know, what you want is not the actual number of people that is sick. This is not coming from Twitter. But what you want is there is more activity in Texas than in Minnesota. What is the relative strength of the season in the different geographical places? So that this helps in the calibration of the model.
In this way, Twitter basically serves to tether the model to reality, along with the multitude of other data streams that the model incorporates. So how well does it work?
Well, the model works well. It has good accuracy for the 1 week, 2 weeks prediction. And then the more you, push the prediction ahead, 3, 4 weeks or 6 weeks, obviously the model lose accuracy. And this is exactly, again, like for weather forecast. If I will tell you what is the weather in 2 months from now, you will laugh at me. And so that's what the model does. Obviously, we want to improve this horizon and get to far and far predictions with more and more accuracy. One needs to understand that those models are statistical in nature, exactly like, again, the weather forecast. You will get a rain probability, a chance of rain at a certain time of the day or of the week. And the same is for diseases. You get a certain chance of having a certain intensity of the flu at that week.
Both the weather and disease outbreaks are based on forces that we can understand and model, like warm air fronts or viral incubation periods. But because both of them are also inherently chaotic or random, predicting them accurately is hard. Not every sick person will pass on the disease to other people, for example. But there is one major way that disease transmission models are different to weather forecasting models.
The hurricane doesn't care about our prediction, while actually the society cares about our prediction on the disease. And so, especially for diseases which have an impact on the society, our knowledge of the future evolution of the disease might change the individual's behavior. And that enters the forecast itself. And so, again, we have to factor also behavioral changes in those projections, and that provides a finite horizon to what we can project for diseases.
So I guess, in a way, you have to build into the model the effect that the model will have?
Well, in a sense, that would be one of the things, but mostly is measuring in real time what is the change of behavior. So is the people leaving business as usual, or is changing the behavior and prefers to work from home because of the fear of the disease. Obviously, for the seasonal flu, there is no change in behavior generally. Although, if you know that if it's a strong season, you might have people that is more concerned, is washing more their hands, you know, avoiding to stay in crowded places, and also that has effect. But, you know, for more lethal diseases, this can be a very strong effect. People might be scared and not drop the kids to school, not go to work, and you want to integrate in any modeling as quickly as possible those change of features, because that will change your synthetic world in which you are doing the forecast. They will change your equations that describe the evolution of the disease.
Using these synthetic digital worlds as a simulation for real life, it's also possible to learn all kinds of things about how the outbreak is progressing.
You get also estimates of epidemiological quantities, like the incubation time, the percentage of people that is immune or vaccinated to the disease, and also what is basically how many people will be infected on average by every infectious people. So you get also a kind of insight on the particular flu of that year that is helpful in describing the season.
So, it seems like scientists have come a fair way since Google Flu Trends. Today, social media provides so much data that if it's analysed properly, it can be a really powerful way to monitor disease outbreaks and give governments and healthcare providers an early warning. But there are still things that modellers have to be wary of. Aside from the dangers of spurious correlations and irrelevant hashtags, the other obvious thing is that Twitter doesn't represent the whole of society. Here's Guy Poppy again.
It's one opportunity, it's a tool in a toolbox. One of the things we do need to be aware of is that clearly it's a certain type of person in society, a certain demographic age range that tends to use it. So, for instance, the people who tend to encounter food poisoning most frequently because of how they cook tends to be males living by themselves over 75 who don't tend to be the biggest users of Twitter. So it's not the best way to hear what they're doing or to communicate with them. But there are other ways in which we can do that. But where social media can be very, very useful is obviously beginning to message to a very active and mobilised group. They're also the group who are most likely to follow various food trends. So again, it's quite a good beacon in on changing practices by people who are kind of telling you how life is changing and that.
And life is certainly changing. According to some estimates, by 2020, a third of everyone on Earth will use some form of social media. As the amount of data continues to pile up, and as we get better at analysing it, what could be possible in the future?
Social media will provide not just aggregate prediction at the statistical level, but in principle could provide single individual prediction. So what is your probability of getting infected in the next few days? You know, this is something that we could even project in a few years, going to what we call personalized medicine, but actually this goes into personalized forecast for your own disease risk because of your movement, the places you go, and the level of activity of, for instance, of the flu in those different places.
What, so you could have like an app on your smartwatch or on your phone that would be able to tell you what the chances are of you picking up flu?
Yeah, I think this is something that is not complete. Obviously, I'm not talking about something that is around the corner, not something that will be tomorrow, but this is something that I can start seeing precursors of that possibility.
Even if personalised infection forecasts are a few years off, national scale forecasts could be here much sooner. Places like the FSA and the CDC are getting better and better at converting the messy mass of data from our digital lives into tools that could keep us healthier and protect us from diseases in real life.
It's very important, I always tell, you don't want to have one single model. Those challenges are made to have a portfolio of models that provide consistent information that can be compounded together in a picture that is more and more reliable, and is more reliable because you have this portfolio of models. And this is, you know, this is the future. So I think that this is the evolution of the field, and I'm optimistic that those models will be used more and more in the future.
That's it for this month. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, it would really help us out if you could leave us a nice review or some stars on your favourite podcast provider. This show was edited and produced by me, Anand Jagatia. We'll be back next month, but until then, you can keep up to date with the Society on our website, microbiologysociety.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and read the stuff on our award-winning blog, The Micropost, at micropost.org. Bye!